or someone you know struggle with past trauma? Has it shown up as insomnia, anxiety, or depressed moods? Or despite your efforts to ignore it, do you feel tired and overwhelmed with life? If you're ready to learn about the long-term effects of trauma, especially with COVID-19, stay tuned. Welcome to Inner Vision. I'm your host, Nita Valens, and this is where we talk about health, psychology, spirituality, and your well-being. Today on Inner Vision, we'll be speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Stanley. She's an associate professor at Georgetown University and speaks, teaches, and writes widely on a variety of topics related to resilience and decision-making. She is an award-winning author, and her latest book, our topic today, is Widen the Window: Training Your Brain and Body to Thrive During Stress and Recover from Trauma. She's the creator of Mindfulness-Based Mind Fitness Training, MMFT, and is also a certified practitioner of Somatic Experiencing, a body-based trauma therapy. Welcome to Inner Vision.
Thank you so much, Nita, for having me.
You're welcome. So let's talk about the book a little bit. We're going to talk about so many things in this hour. I'm very excited. When you say widen the window, I know you're talking about a concept from psychology right there. Can you talk about what that window is and why it's important?
Yes. So the window in the title is the window of tolerance to stress arousal that each of us wire over the course of our lifetimes. And when we're inside our window, we have both the thinking brain and survival brain, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. They're both online and they can work together as allies. We're able to function well during stressful experiences. We're able to make conscious decisions and access choice. And when we have a wider window, we can do that during even more stressful experiences. People with wide windows are much more tolerant of change, of uncertainty. They're much more flexible when life throws them a curveball. They're better able to adapt when their plans get interrupted. And importantly, they can also stay in touch with people, give and receive social support even during stressful situations. So we all have this window. It starts wiring during our third trimester in the womb and continues wiring throughout our life. And it can narrow through stressful and traumatic experiences, as I'm sure we'll talk about today. But we can widen it. And that's why I went with the widen part for the title. We can make conscious choices to help build that tolerance to stress in our minds and body.
Well, that's a great concept. And I use it in my work also. So I love that you wrote about that. And I want to just kind of give a plug to one of my favorite people on the planet in the realm of psychology, trauma, and dissociation, who's Dr. Bessel van der Kolk.
Yes.
And he wrote the foreword to your book. He's a very busy guy, and if he wrote the foreword to your book, that got my attention because he is one of the greats in our field, I think. So,
he is clearly a pioneer in the field, and he's been a really wonderful mentor to me. I was very honored when he offered to write the foreword.
So speaking of you, Liz, let's talk about what happened to you and what got you to be interested in this topic and write this book. And I know you've written a lot of other things as well, but to help people in trauma recovery. It's so timely right now, especially with COVID, which we're going to get to in a little bit. But share a little about your story.
Yes. You know, Nita, I think for those of us who do research, and Bessel actually starts the foreword this way, saying, you know, most research is me-search.
Yeah.
And it's really true. We write about what we need to learn. And I definitely am exhibit A for all the different ways that a window can get narrowed in life. And then I needed to heal and widen my own window. And then I wanted to share what I learned with others. I experienced a lot of stress and trauma in my life, multi-generational trauma. I come from a long military lineage. My father and my grandfather both saw combat and experienced PTSD after that. I experienced a variety of different forms of childhood adversity and sexual assault and rape. And then I served in the military myself and, you know, stressful military training. I did 2 deployments as a peacekeeper in the Balkans. And during the second deployment, when I was in Bosnia, I had a near-death experience. And then when I left active duty, I was in graduate school, and all of the decades of coping the way I had been socialized to cope by kind of shoving it under, compartmentalizing, powering through, it all kind of came due. My body was just done with carrying that burden any longer without, you know, it was like frying pan upside my head. It was time to learn to do things differently. I suffered from PTSD and depression myself, but also a range of physical illnesses and insomnia. And I had Lyme disease, but I didn't know it. And eventually I lost my eyesight. And that was kind of, that's what got my attention. Training to become a professor and starting on the tenure track and losing my eyesight was like, okay, it's time to find a new way to be in the world. So I went through a whole long healing journey myself. I did the clinical training you mentioned. I created mindfulness-based mind fitness training. I spent a decade partnering with neuroscientists and stress researchers to test the efficacy of MFIT with troops before they prepared for combat deployment. We published that research in peer-reviewed science journals. I've shared MFIT widely with a lot of different high-stress populations. And all that experience kind of came together in the book. So it's kind of a blend of my story, the stories of the men and women I've trained, and some of the science, actually a lot of the science, because it was really important for me when I was trying to understand why my mind and body were acting the way they were, to begin to see that there were scientific reasons for that. And it helped me take it much less personally. It helped me understand why it was happening, and then also the leverage points for having it be different. And I wanted to share that with readers, too, so that as they are on their own healing journeys, they can understand why their minds and bodies act as they do, and they can also understand where they have choice in rewiring it and making it better and different.
That's an amazing story. And you did end up getting your eyesight back?
I did. I had about a year and a half where it would come and go, but then it did start to recover. My optic nerves have fully healed over time. The body is a very resilient thing, but it was, I think, exactly what I needed at that time. My system could not keep going the way it was, and I needed to learn a new way of doing it. And that was, you know, as I said, kind of a cosmic frying pan upside my head to get my attention.
I think that happens to a lot of people, and maybe we don't realize it until after the fact. We don't realize that the window of tolerance is narrowing, and we're just adding more stuff and more stuff as if we're invincible, and then we crash and burn. I think that's a real common situation, and I think that it's important for people to understand that we have to take care of ourselves in new ways today, because in the last 30 years, the science of the brain and what the brain is really capable of has really exploded. And also our lives have become more stressful, and technology that was supposed to make it easier has made things more complicated and more is demanded of us. I love what you said a minute ago about the brain, the parts of the brain, and how we need to learn, like, what our limitations are, in a sense. Can we talk about that a little bit and go back to distinguishing some of the recent research in neuroscience and thinking brain and the survival brain?
Absolutely. I really appreciate what you just said there, Nita, about how much we think we can just keep going. And we're very socialized collectively to be that way. We place a lot of value in our culture on always being on. You know, Angela Duckworth, a psychologist at Penn, popularized and wrote a best-selling book called Grit, this idea that you can be gritty and constantly going and doing and enduring. And that's only half of the story. You know, the mind and body can go a really long time, but it also needs recovery. And that piece has been missing in most of our popular kind of understanding of it. And that, I think, is part of what I really wanted to help convey to people. So I use the terms thinking brain and survival brain. I want to be super clear that the neuroscience isn't suggesting that there are like two regions in the brain. In fact, the wiring, the circuitry, is very overlapping between these things. I use those terms to help differentiate these two sets of very important functions. But I want to be clear that it's not like there's two places in the brain that you can point to. That's pretty clear from the neuroscience.
Good to know. So, thank you.
What I call the thinking brain is the functions that are in our evolutionarily newer parts of the brain, predominantly the prefrontal cortex, you know, up in our forehead. But again, it extends throughout the brain. And these are the functions that allow us to pay attention, to consciously remember something, to prioritize between tasks, to make plans and follow through on plans, to make conscious decisions. All of that is sort of known as executive functioning, decision making, our explicit memory that we can intentionally recall. And importantly, the last thinking brain function that I want to mention is willpower, the ability to kind of curb cravings and keep going when we don't necessarily want to keep going and interrupt habits we don't want to have and build the habits we do want to have. Willpower is an important thinking brain function. So all of these functions together are thinking brain functions. All of them work best at moderate stress arousal. And it's one of the reasons, I think, why caffeine is so deeply loved in our culture.
Oh, yes.
Because a hit a cup of coffee sort of gets people right at that prime point. And you probably know from experience, you have a cup of coffee, your attention is sharper, right? And
yes.
So the thinking brain likes one cup of coffee. But our thinking brain functions get degraded when we are experiencing chronic stress or when we're experiencing very high stress levels in the realm of traumatic stress. And I want to flag that, and we'll come back to the implications of that later on, because
okay.
As I said, that's conscious decision-making, paying attention, and willpower, all of these things very adversely affected by chronic stress and trauma. The survival brain functions, they're definitely mostly resident in the evolutionarily older parts of the brain, the brainstem, the cerebellum, the middle of the brain. And the survival brain controls survival functions. That's why I use that term. So one of the most important survival brain functions is an unconscious threat appraisal process. It's going on all the time. Stephen Porges uses the term neuroception for this threat appraisal. It's happening all the time. It's mostly happening in the amygdala. And when the survival brain perceives something to be threatening or challenging, this neuroception process, if it's a neuroception of danger or challenge, it will turn stress arousal on. That's what it exists to do, and it mobilizes energy to help get us be safe. That's what that is all about. To support that threat appraisal process, the survival brain has an implicit memory system. So it's an unconscious memory system. And it's kind of a bank of all the prior moments of neuroception we've ever had in our life. We can't consciously access this, but this is where our survival brain catalogs and can very quickly access all of these prior moments when we potentially had threat or challenge, and then it can respond from that. And if it neurocepts challenge or danger, it turns stress on, it mobilizes energy for that, we go into fight or flight or eventually into freeze. And if it neurocepts safety, then it turns on all of the recovery functions and turns on our social bonding, our social engagement functions. So all of this is happening unconsciously. We can't consciously control it. We can't hear the survival brain. Like, you can hear your thinking brain, you know, you hear your mind talking to you or narrating in your head.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of know what's happening with your thinking brain. You can't know what's happening with the survival brain from inside the head. We can only see its effects in our body, in the physical sensations it produces, in the emotions it produces. And unlike the thinking brain, which gets degraded when we have chronic stress, the survival brain is always learning. And the more stressful something is, the more the survival brain functions are learning from that. So the greater the stress level, the more the survival brain learns and remembers. And the reason why that's so important is that when we experience trauma, we're experiencing the highest level of stress arousal. And that's when the survival brain is learning and remembering the most. And that's when the thinking brain is most offline. And it's one of the reasons why, for those of us who've experienced a lot of trauma in our lives, our minds and bodies can often react in ways that we don't understand. And we wonder why we did that or why we, quote, overreacted. And it's the survival brain playing out all of this important learning that it had from previous traumatic events that our thinking brain really isn't consciously aware of. So I know this was a really long answer, Nita, but I wanted to unpack that a bit because I think it's really important for people to understand how much, whether we're stressed or not, is up to the survival brain, and yet most of us have never learned about the survival brain functions or how to influence them at all.
I'm really glad you said all that because I think it's important for us to really understand what's going on, because I think part of the problem going back decades is we were told, well, you know, the brain cells don't regenerate. The brain you got is the brain you got. And there were all these areas of misinformation. Now, today, we know so much more. So I think it's important to realize that because kind of where we're going with this in the next segment or two is that even though this is all going on and even though this whole process with the survival brain is unconscious, we can still take steps to get ourselves out of dysregulation.
Yes.
And the more that we understand about how this works, and then we'll cover the central nervous system a little bit and how that dovetails in, the more we then can say, oh, I'm just feeling really stressed today. I have a headache. I think I better stop and go meditate for 20 minutes or listen to my app or something like that. There are solutions out there. So we'll get to those a bit later. But I think it's really important to understand this. And that's why I like your book. I'm about a quarter of the way through, and you do in the book, Widen the Window, Training Your Brain and Body to Thrive During Stress and Recover from Trauma, in case anyone didn't catch the title earlier, you go into a great deal of detail so that we can understand this. And I think that's really useful. The other thing that's just popped in my mind is when Dr. Bessel van der Kolk wrote the foreword, he said that one of his favorite things about your book is that you give your experience, but you also give science and process. And a lot of books are just completely academic or scientific. And then a lot of other books are just a story of what happened to somebody. And those are all valuable and useful. But it's nice to have it all rolled into one the way you wrote this book, Widen the Window. So I really wanted to let you know that's very appreciated.
Thank you, Nita. I always think it's easier to learn with stories, but I really also think it's so important for us to understand why our minds and bodies are wired the way they are. So I wanted to roll both pieces together, and I'm glad that that's been working for you, and I hope it works for other listeners who might want to pick the book up too.
Absolutely. So I just want to ask a question to tie this to the central nervous system, because we talk about the parasympathetic, the calm side of the nervous system. We talk about the sympathetic, the side that gets triggered and goes into fight, flight, or freeze. And the reason why I want to bring that in is I've talked a lot about this on this program, and I want to tie that to what you're saying about the brain, because that's a signal that, again, we're under too much stress and we have to take a step to reduce that stress.
Yes. So when the survival brain neurocepts threat or challenge, it will signal with several different hormones to start to turn on the sympathetic nervous system. And that's what mobilizes all of the energy for fight or flight. They're both mobilized defenses through the sympathetic nervous system. And if the survival brain, as it does that first wave of stress arousal, and then our body starts to try and respond to the situation, it then does sort of a second wave of appraisal to see, do I have the resources I need to deal with this situation or not? And in that kind of second wave where it is starting to kind of figure out the right amount of stress hormones to turn on, in that second wave, and it's a very fast second wave, like it's a 1-2 process. In that very fast second wave, if it perceives that we don't have enough resources, that it perceives us to be helpless or powerless or lacking control in the situation, then it's going to turn on a whole lot of stress hormones. And the nervous system is going to perceive that neither fight nor flight are feasible. And so in addition to the sympathetic nervous system being turned on, at that point, it will also turn on the dorsal part of the parasympathetic nervous system. It runs down the back side of the body, and it turns it on in a defensive mode, and that moves us into the realm of freeze. And anybody kind of is familiar with the freeze idea. If you think about a possum playing dead, a possum's nervous system is, any mammal's nervous system is like ours, with a parasympathetic and a sympathetic branch. The possum falls back into freeze very, very quickly. It is one of its kind of main defenses. It doesn't do fight or flight very much. It goes right into freeze. Humans go into freeze too. It's different. We don't actually end up, quote, playing dead, but our whole demeanor gets very slack. Our voice loses its modulation. We stop being able to control our head and neck muscles. And it's our body starting to move towards shutdown for a potential, you know, sometimes being immobilized is the only way to actually survive a situation. And when we're living through a freeze, it can feel like time is completely slowed down and we might not really remember the situation. We might lose some of our hearing or our vision. And, you know, it's the oldest of the possible defenses. And for someone who experiences a freeze during a traumatic event and then they don't fully recover afterwards, that's kind of the number one correlate in the literature around PTSD for someone eventually developing post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's remarkably common. If anyone's ever had a car accident where you know that the moment of impact is coming and like time slows down, that's when we've moved into a freeze place.
Absolutely. That's a good place for us to stop right here to take our first break. With me is Dr. Elizabeth Stanley. Her book is Widen the Window, Training Your Brain and Body to Thrive During Stress and Recover from Trauma. And she does so much more, and we'll come back with more. And after this break, I think we're going to go into an overview of how people have been and continue to be traumatized by the pandemic and by the coronavirus information coming out that is changing just about every 5 minutes. This is Inner Vision. We'll be right back.
Beyond politics and above religion, consciousness, the fundamental nature of reality, the ageless wisdom.
Tune in to the Ageless Wisdom Mystery School with your host, Michael Benner, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. right here at KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and streaming live at kpfk.org.
The Ageless Wisdom.
Welcome back to Inner Vision. With me today is Dr. Elizabeth Stanley, and we are talking about trauma and stress and some solutions that are on the table for you if you're experiencing this. And I'm pretty sure that just about everybody on the planet is experiencing some level of stress, all the way to traumatic events due to the pandemic and the coronavirus. So what are your thoughts on how we are changing because of the last year? Because we just about came out of a 10-month period going into the new year where who would have thought we would still be trying to shelter at home to a certain extent and trying to limit contact with family and friends. It's all very stressful because we're wired to connect, right?
We absolutely are wired to connect. And this has ended our world. And it hasn't just been the pandemic. I mean, this has been a year with some of the most extreme weather events on record for our nation, with the wildfires and floods. Hurricane season this year was really bad. We had a very stressful election season that still is not completely resolved. We've had a tremendous amount of change in terms of people having to supervise their children learning virtually, teachers having to teach virtually, people having to be separated from family. Just there's been so many different things that have made this year unique, totally separate from the virus. And of course, the virus is amplifying it as well. You know, in the last segment, we were talking about neuroception, that unconscious threat appraisal process that the survival brain does. And when the survival brain is perceiving stressors, and stressors have certain characteristics, it's going to find them more threatening and more challenging, and then turn on more stress arousal. And there are four characteristics that the survival brain is looking for in stressors. Is the stressor novel? Is it new and unfamiliar? Is it unpredictable? That's the second one. Is it perceived as uncontrollable? And finally, the fourth one is it perceived as threatening to our sense of identity and our physical survival? Well, guess what? COVID's been all of those. I mean, it's been this brand new thing. It's been totally unpredictable. It's been uncontrollable in terms of we have plans. We want to restart our lives. We want to restart our communities and reopen our businesses. But nope, we just can't. And it's been threatening to our physical survival. At this point, with the number of infections that we've seen, everybody knows at least one person at this point who has been infected or who may have passed from this. And it's continuing to go. And that part, too, feels so unpredictable and uncontrollable. And even though there is a vaccine now, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about the timing of it, the timing of rolling out the vaccinations, how many people are going to need to get vaccinated until we get to herd immunity. Like, that process of restarting communities after we hit enough people being vaccinated and people even debating whether they want to be vaccinated, all of that is just continuing to contribute to all of these ways that our survival brains continue to feel threatened by this situation. And for most of us, many, many, many people have coped by trying to help their thinking brains feel more comfortable with the situation. That's how many of us are socialized and taught to cope with stress. You know, so our thinking brains want more information. They don't like uncertainty. Our thinking brains love to be able to predict what's going to happen next. And if it isn't like something that they've happened before, then they want to go out and gather information so they can predict. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why people are so addicted to their social media feed, to having the news on all the time, because they want more information. Their thinking brains are craving it. And even if you're not craving the information, your thinking brain is trying to figure it out anyway. I mean, I'm sure many people listening to this show, if they're paying attention at all to what's happening unconsciously, you know, this little habit in their head of what if, what if, what if, our minds are always trying to anticipate and predict and prevent unwanted things from happening. All of those things may help our thinking brains feel calmer, but unfortunately, any time we're gathering more information about the pandemic or about the political situation or about wildfires or other natural disasters or about the economy or about when our kids' schools are opening, or any time we're just letting our minds run with it, like, what if we don't have vaccines by be able to start the school again in fall? What if businesses can't reopen? And what if I can't meet my mortgage and I'm going to be evicted from my house? It's going to be foreclosed. Anytime our minds are doing that, our thinking brain may feel calmer, but it's actually turning on stress arousal because our survival brain is finding it threatening. It's one of the real paradoxes about something that is this uncertain. What we tend to think is going to make it feel better actually is turning more stress on. And so being able to understand that and then choose to interrupt those habits and choose to replace them with things that help our survival brains feel more grounded and feel a little bit more with some agency, that's the only way to help kind of get through it.
Well, that's very ironic, really, because it's like the thinking brain wants data, but the data is very confusing and often very alarming because they keep saying the numbers are going up, the numbers are going up for the virus. Then we're getting triggered on the other side of the brain, so to speak, the survival brain. So at what point then do we say, okay, this is too stressful. I don't need all this data. I'm going to turn the news off and listen 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes at night to headlines, that's it, or something like that. I mean, at some point, we have to figure out how we're going to modify our behavior with media and with social media so that we don't end up level 10 stress triggered and can't function and do what we need to do in our daily lives.
That's exactly where I was going to be headed next, Nita. Yes, you are exactly right. Because the more we keep allowing ourselves to be triggered in that way, the more the survival brain feels helpless, powerless, and lacking control. And remember, whenever the survival brain is feeling helpless, powerless, lacking control, we're moving ourselves into the realm of trauma. And that makes it that much harder to recover. So when I designed MFIT, Mindfulness-Based Mind Fitness Training, I designed it on that scientific principle When we perceive ourselves to have less agency, we're more likely to experience trauma. And so the flip side is also true. When we can access agency, when we can find and really recognize we have choice and then act on that choice, when we do that, that's protective. It protects us from trauma. And that's what I wanted to train people to be able to do, even in really stressful situations. When we train our minds and bodies to access choice in any situation, it protects us from high stress levels. It protects us from trauma. And then there are lots of things we can't control. We can't control so many things. But one thing that is always under our control, if we've been training ourselves this way, is we always have a choice about where we're directing our attention. And wherever our attention is being directed, that is having these profound ripple effects through the survival brain's neuroception process and then rippling through into our nervous system and into our body. If we're directing our attention in ways that help our survival brain feel safe, then we're more grounded. Then we are not so stressed. And when we are directing our attention in ways that our survival brain is going to neurocept threat or challenge, then we're turning stress on. And that's up to us. Most of us have not been aware of that, and our brains have developed lots of habit patterns that are kind of costly for the survival brain. Worrying, what if, kind of catastrophizing, that's very costly. Multitasking, actually, the literature shows, has a lot of costly effects for the survival brain. And even being on autopilot with mind wandering actually has a lot of costs on our mood and on our survival brain as well. So most of us aren't paying attention to where our attention is, and it's off in these habits, and it actually is making it harder for our minds and bodies. And that's why I created MFIT, to help people begin to find ways to train their attention so that their attention can be much more consciously directed and can be directed at target objects that help the survival brain feel safe, so that it will turn on recovery functions and help widen our window.
And we are going to talk in some detail in the next segment about MFIT. You created something called Mindfulness-Based Mind Fitness Training. But before we get to that, one of the things I want to make sure that we mention so that families understand, in particular parents and grandparents taking care of little ones, that the enduring distress and fear created by the pandemic causes a lot of trauma in adults and children, and the trauma can manifest differently in children than in adults. So I want to talk about that a little bit, and also the long-term effects if left untreated.
Yes. Well, as you said a while ago, Nita, we are social animals. We are wired to connect. And as a result, our minds and bodies are always resonating with the social environment around us. And when we're stressed and when we're experiencing a lot of negative emotions, we have the potential to convey those to the people around us. Stress and emotions are contagious. And they're most contagious in relationships where we have attachment bonds, so with our romantic partners, with our parents, with our children. And they're also really contagious in relationships with power differences. So between a teacher and their students, a doctor and their patients, a therapist and their clients, a boss and their followers, and a leader and their followers. And unfortunately, we are living in a time when there are a lot of dysregulated leaders and bosses and teachers, and they are conveying that, and a lot of dysregulated parents, and they're conveying it too. So, you know, as adults, we have fully wired all parts of our nervous system and our brain and our body. And so we have some capacity to interrupt that in a way that children don't have quite that same capacity because they have not yet finished wiring. You know, the autonomic nervous system wires until someone is about 18, and parts of the thinking brain continue wiring until we're in our early 30s. So for children and teenagers, they have much less inner resources and much less kind of neurobiological capacity to interrupt stress contagion. So when parents are really stressed out or really anxious or really sad or really angry, their kids are picking that up. And, you know, I often talk to parents who, this was a case in my own house growing up, so I lived it myself, but it's been interesting to talk to parents who are doing it from a very loving or well-intentioned manner. You know, they say, well, I'm just going to shove my own emotions under. I'm going to act as if nothing's going on when I'm around my children. I'm going to pretend that everything is fine, and I'm not going to show them that I'm anxious. I'm not going to show them that I'm sad or angry, and, you know, I'm going to pretend it's all okay. And they think that that's helpful for their kids, but actually it isn't, because when we are suppressing our emotions, that is still in our nervous system and in our body, and it's still conveying. It's still contagious. And in fact, suppressed emotions are even more contagious. Suppressed stress arousal is even more contagious to our kids than when we are actively naming it and acknowledging it consciously. And so kids are picking up on that, and their systems are picking up on it. And yet if mom and dad are acting as if everything is okay, even though the kid is feeling, the child is picking up on that stress and anger or fear. But if mom and dad are saying everything's fine, then the child is getting these conflicting messages. Their thinking brain is being told nothing's going on, but they can feel in their body, in their nervous system, in their survival brain, that everything isn't okay. And that's very confusing for children. That actually is part of what makes things so traumatic for kids. Because again, just like for adults, if the child's survival brain is perceiving that they are helpless or powerless or lacking control, they can't make it better for mommy. They can see mommy isn't feeling well, even though mommy's saying she's fine. That's very traumatic for a child. And that's having long-term effects. It's having long-term effects on the way that that child's brain and body are being wired. And I have a couple chapters in the book where I lay out all of the neurobiological effects that it has. It has lifelong effects. And, you know, it's really challenging during this past year to watch so many children in this environment where they can't go out, they can't spend time with their friends, they're not able to move their bodies and play as much as they normally would, they're not able to socialize with other kids as much as they would, and that's having effects on their minds and bodies wiring too. And I know parents are doing the best that they can, and yet we are going to be seeing some long-term effects collectively from what this period has been and what it will continue to do for our minds and body. I'm sorry, that was a really long-winded answer there, Nita.
Actually, it was very useful, because I'll tell you why. I think that so much of our culture has messages like, okay, so, you know, you're upset, get over it, get on with your day. Okay, so you had a bad day or you had stress, but, you know, you have to pick yourself up by your bootstraps and move on. There's a lot of messages in our culture, A, not to feel our feelings, B, not to acknowledge what happened and try to remediate it in any way, and C, to just, well, you know, you're like the Energizer Bunny on TV, and, you know, we just have to keep going and do our lives. And you had an experience where you did that and you crashed and burned. I've had the same thing where I did that and crashed and burned. And, like, how many more generations do we have to put through kind of learning this the hard way, that we really are, in a sense, fragile beings in regards to, you know, we can only take so much stress and trauma. So don't we need to cut ourselves a break and at least acknowledge it and learn ways to be managing our stress and processing our traumas?
Absolutely. I really appreciate what you just said, Nita. It's one of the ways that our thinking brains are actually like our own worst enemies. The yes. way that our minds will often say, well, you know, I don't have it nearly as bad as that person has it, or, right. Oh, this really wasn't that big a deal, or I still have my job, I still have my house, I still have my health, I still, you know, whatever the sentences are that we use. And again, these are things that help our thinking brain kind of dismiss it or make it seem like it's not such a big deal. But when our thinking brains do that, they're actually devaluing, dismissing the thing that is causing stress for our survival brain. And when our thinking brain devalues and dismisses our stress, guess what? Our survival brain is a little bit like a toddler. It's like, wait a minute, you didn't get my message. And so it gets even more stressed. It's like a child who's trying to get your attention and they're tugging on your pant leg and you're like, it's okay. And you go back to your conversation with another adult and then the child starts tantruming. That's what our survival brains do when we keep pushing it under like that and writing it off as no big deal. It's amazing how many people I've trained who say, well, you know, I shouldn't be having this experience because I wasn't in combat or I was never raped like you were or whatever the big shock trauma events they can think of. But our survival brains don't work that way. That's not how they determine whether they're going to turn stress on or off. And I really want people to understand that there are ways we can help speak our survival brain's language.
Yes.
And yes, maybe in the biggest scheme of things, it's not the end of the world, but it still is stressful for our survival brain right now. And we have to find ways to work with that skillfully.
Absolutely. Okay, so we are going to take another quick break here on InnerVision. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how people can begin to recover from the stress of COVID-19 and other events when the future is so unpredictable. And we're going to let Dr. Elizabeth Stanley share some information about her MFIT program. All of this coming right up on InnerVision. We'll be right back.
Become a member of your favorite radio station. Log on now to kpfk.org.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO, and we'll take care of everything. No, really, it's that simple.
Welcome back to InnerVision. With me today is Dr. Elizabeth Stanley, and she has written a book called Widen the Window, Training Your Brain and Body to Thrive During Stress and Recover from Trauma. So let's talk about solutions now. What do you think people can begin to do when everything is still so uncertain and unpredictable, like we were talking about earlier? You know, there's a lot of fallout still happening with the election results that's very stressful for people. We have the pandemic continuing, the numbers going up in certain states. You know, there's triage going on outside of hospitals. And we have people recovering from the natural weather disasters. We have a lot on our plates.
Yes. So it should be clear, Nita, by now that one of the most important takeaways from this whole time that we've been talking for listeners is only our survival brain decides whether we're turning stress on or whether we're turning stress off and then turning on recovery functions. And so we need to be really intentional and conscious participants in figuring out how to help our survival brain to neurocept safety so that it will turn stress off and it will turn recovery functions on. And it all comes down to two things: what we're paying attention to and what we are choosing to invest in terms of our habits. Our neurobiology is the result of lots of repeated experiences. The way we wire our brain, the way we wire our body, you even know it from when you work out, the way you wire your muscles and your cardiovascular system. These things change from repeated experience. And so when we marry up how we're paying attention and getting good repeated experiences that are skillful in helping to rewire our body, those two things together can lead to some really tremendous effects. So we have choice in where we're directing our attention. If we direct our attention in ways that help our survival brain perceive safety, it's going to turn recovery on. It's just wired that way. So in the book, I lay out a variety of window widening habits that we can invest in that help our survival brain feel safe, help us recover from the stress loads that we have built up as we've narrowed our windows. The single most important thing that I like to recommend and that the literature is pretty clear on, having window narrowing effects or widening effects, depending on how we're doing it, is sleep. We get an enormous amount of recovery functions underway when we're getting good sleep. And ideally, we're getting 8 hours a night, and it's restful sleep. And so whatever you can do to set yourself up to get 8 uninterrupted hours of restful sleep, you know, setting up your evening in a way that you are disconnecting from your devices for at least an hour before bed, that you're not eating right at bedtime, that you're not drinking too much alcohol so that you get poor sleep. So you're getting exercise in the day to help support good sleep, that you're getting access to light early in the day to help reset the circadian rhythm to set up good sleep. I can never say enough about sleep. Sleep is really, really important. That's one thing that people can do. A second thing that people can do is really focus on helping their microbiome to be in the best place possible to boost their immunity. The microbiome is all the gut bacteria, the flora in our digestive tract. And our diet has tremendous effects on whether we are moving our bodies towards chronic inflammation, which is underneath so many different physical and mental health chronic conditions, or if we're moving us towards much better immunity, because so much of our immune system resides in the microbiome in our gut. So a really healthy diet. Third thing is physical exercise, making sure that we are getting cardiovascular exercise at least 3 or 4 times each week, which helps us expend some stress hormones and helps to turn off some of that chronic inflammation. A fourth thing is really investing in our relationships, spending time with people, even if it's virtually over Zoom or FaceTime, spending time with people where we really are connecting and where we are showing our emotions and hearing about others' emotions. Like, we are giving our survival brains a chance to really connect. We're wired to connect, and we need that. And then the last window widening habit has to do with training our attention. And this is what MFIT is all focused about, helping to train our attention, to redirect our attention to the attentional cues that help the survival brain to feel safe. MFIT is an 8-week course, 20 hours of training over 8 weeks, and we asked all the participants, men and women who are deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan in these studies and in other high-stress situations, we've done research as well, to practice the exercises outside of the class time. And on average, they were practicing only about 12 minutes a day. So it isn't like a really huge commitment, but consistent practice each day of training our attention in ways that help the survival brain to neurocept safety. And it, you know, has led to a lot of really beneficial changes in our published research, better cognitive performance, better regulation of emotions, more efficient stress arousal, faster recovery after stress, improvements in sleep, better immune functioning, better biomarkers of resilience. And all of this came from changes in brain activation patterns and the parts of the brain that control pain and impulses and emotions. And all this came from practicing about 12 minutes a day. So developing a daily practice for reflection or awareness or both. Those are the window widening habits. And I guess there's one last thing I'd say that isn't a window widening habit, but kind of something to keep in mind with the window widening habits. We said a little while ago that we're social animals. We're wired to connect. We're also wired to be resonating with our surroundings all the time. Our nervous system is always resonating with our surroundings. So when we're surrounded by anxious and stressed people, or we're sitting in traffic, or we're streaming a horror movie or an action movie, our nervous system and our body are getting stressed out and activated. Conversely, if we're sitting with people who are very grounded and regulated, if we're outside in nature, if we are spending time in a warm bath, if we're listening to soothing music, all of those kinds of things are resonating and helping our nervous system to downregulate as well. So again, sleep, diet, exercise, social connections, training attention, and then being super aware of what our surroundings are, what our mind and body is resonating with, because the surroundings can help amp us up, and they can also help to downregulate us back into a grounded state.
So one of the things that comes to mind while you were giving all that wonderful information, and again, we're talking about widening our window of tolerance so that we can function without getting depressed, lethargic, without panic, without anxiety at the high end. And so these are all great tools. What I think happens with a lot of people is that they know these tools are available. They know they should sleep, correct diet, some exercise. attention on pleasant things, monitor your relationships energetically, notice if someone is draining you or if you feel good with them energetically when you're together and things like that. A lot of people really know this, but I think what happens is we get caught up in the day. Or we get caught up in the moment or the week or, oh my gosh, I have this due date on Friday about this project. And then it's kind of like what happened with you and with me. We both crashed and burned working on our doctoral stuff, I'll say. And so how is it that we can even notice what's going on to even employ the tools?
Well, that's a great question, Nita. And as I said back in the first segment, I was going to put a pin in it about willpower, and I wanted to kind of close the loop on that now.
Yes.
When we are experiencing chronic stress, when we are constantly on the go and we're not giving ourselves any space for reflection or recovery, our willpower gets degraded. Just like all thinking brain functions, our decision-making gets degraded. We're much more likely to have stress and emotions driving our decisions instead of our conscious intentions. We're much more likely to be putting out fires that are immediately in front of us instead of necessarily attending to what's most important for our long-term personal and professional well-being. We've all been in this pattern. And when we're in that pattern, our willpower is also degraded. So we're much less likely to be able to interrupt that pull to go have a second or third or fifth glass of wine or interrupt the pull to sit and overeat on some comfort food or whatever it is. Like, we are much more likely to be engaging in what I call stress reaction cycle habits. These are the things that soothe us in the immediate term. They feel good right now, but they're not actually allowing for any true recovery. And so they continue to help us build our stress load, build our allostatic load, and they narrow our window. And the more we engage in those kinds of things, the more we reach for those kinds of things because we're continuing to add stress. And so we're undermining our willpower even more. It's how we can end up getting caught with things like pandemic fatigue, where people are just like climbing the walls and they've been streaming whole seasons of television in a weekend and you know, not necessarily eating the best things and drinking a lot more. I understand why that happens. You know, even I, with all these tools, I have noticed myself falling back into some of those habits again, too. We're human. Of course we are. This has been very, very stressful time. The nice thing is, any moment is indeed a new moment. And when we can understand why we're being pulled that way and how we can interrupt it, even just one little interruption, one little tweak can make a big difference. The tweak I go to when I am finding myself in that situation is I take the dog, put her on the leash, and we go for a brisk walk. Physical movement is great for getting us back into our bodies and back into this present moment. It interrupts all of that kind of inertia of giving into those kinds of habits, the stress reaction cycle habits, and it also interrupts the inertia of our mind that's spinning out of control with, you know, I have this deadline on Friday or whatever it is. So sometimes just one little shift, whether that's going and standing outside for 30 seconds, jumping up and down for 30 seconds, taking a brisk walk around the block, physically moving your body and getting out of your mind and into your body is often a really great way to start interrupting that. And give yourself some compassion around how challenging this time has been. We do always have a new moment, and each new moment is a new choice. We just have to acknowledge that there is inertia from the prior moment, but this is a new moment, and I can choose something different right now.
I like that a lot. I might save that in my quote file, Liz, because I really like that. Any moment is a new moment. Each new moment is a new choice. I love that. And I think also that it occurred to me when we have people close to us, even those that don't live with us, because my best friend is even in another state, that we can invite each other to remind us about what we're trying to do in our self-care. Like, well, what do you mean you're eating another bag of popcorn on the eighth episode of whatever? You just said you ate popcorn an hour and a half ago. Why do you need like another whole bag? I mean, just kind of catch ourselves, confront each other really and say, really, is that your best choice right now? And I don't mean for us to try and control the people we love, but just to say, hey, I'm just noticing, blah, blah, blah.
There's a reason why having a workout buddy is so successful. Like, it's a very successful thing because when we have someone else to be accountable with, but who can also be supportive of us, it's really helpful. It's really important. It interrupts all of that negative self-judgment that we have when we might not follow through with the intention that we wanted. And then that can set us into these awful shame cycles that actually just put us into an even more stressed place and lead us to reach for just more stress reaction cycle habits, right? So to interrupt all of that, having somebody that we can have as our partner through it. You know, I have a daily writing habit. I have a group of girls that we get together every month. And each week, at the end of the week, we send each other an email about what we did. And then once a month, we get together and talk about how our writing is going. Having them there, I coach for a writing group where I'm helping to support other people, and I have to be impeccable in my own habit while I'm watching them, right? It's important when we're making change that is challenging to have people that we can be accountable to and be supportive with. So finding whatever the habit changes you want, whether it's changing your diet, whether it is making sure that you're getting enough sleep, whether it's training your attention or doing physical exercise or doing a daily writing habit or whatever it is, cleaning out your house, having somebody that you can be accountable to and supported by is really important.
Accountability is the biggest thing. It really is. I want to make sure that we have time for you to give resources to people. Where can people find you?
Absolutely. My website, elizabeth-stanley.com. If you join my mailing list, you can get the first exercise in the MFIT sequence for training your attention. It's a 5-minute exercise called the contact point. It's designed to help your survival brain perceive safety and turn recovery on. You can also get links on my website to all the published research about MFIT's efficacy. And you can find a link to the online version of MFIT that we launched last fall with Sounds True. It's available on demand. It's an 8-week course, but it's totally self-paced on your own time, you know, on your own as you want to move through it. And we have a monthly call to answer Q&A. And if you are a public servant, a first responder, a public school teacher, someone working in a hospital during the pandemic, you can also apply to get free access to the course. We want to support people who are helping to keep our collective moving right now.
Thank you so much, Dr. Elizabeth Stanley. And again, the book is called Widen the Window, Training Your Brain and Body to Thrive During Stress and Recover from Trauma. I want to thank Mark Maxwell in production. Ricky Herrera is in master control. We're streaming live on the web at kpfk.org worldwide. And if you miss a program, go to the audio archive link to catch up. The quote I leave you with today is by William James when he said, "The greatest weapon against stress is our ability to choose one thought over another." I'm Nita Valens. Thanks for listening. InnerVision makes no claims to diagnose, treat, prevent, mitigate, or cure diseases, and the information that is discussed on the program is not to be construed as medical advice. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking medical treatment because of something you have heard on or accessed through this radio program.
It's a whole new vibration. KPFK 90.7 and kpfk.org.
This is Donna Walker, host of Pacifica Performance Showcase, airing on Friday afternoons from 2:30 to 3 p.m. right here on KPFK. Covering film, theater, music, and literature, it's arts and culture to enlighten, enliven, and educate. Right here on KPFK 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for the world at www.kpfk.org. Support free speech and freeform radio. Peace.